from the makers of Motown Mafia. Beyond the headlines. Beyond the crime. Beyond the glamours and gold. They don't run around the streets. They run the streets. Beyond Street Dreams. Coming soon.
Be a podcast, Tyrone Stevens, take one.
What's happening, family? This is your man, CRB Jr. here at Big Boss Filmworks, the proud sponsor of Motown Mafia Podcast and, of course, our new station in the Black TV. We are honored and truly have a treat for you guys. We're going to give you some insights into a world often talked about but seldom documented. And we have with us today a legend in his craft. How are you today, Mr. Stevens?
Tyrone, I'm doing Stevens. Fine. Doing fine. How you doing, Courtney?
Man, I'm good. I'm glad that we was able to link up. I guess we should give a shout out to our conduit, Ray Tatum.
Yeah, Ray Tatum, bro.
Who linked us up together, man. Getting off zero. That's a fact. Yeah. And you're native Detroit, is that right?
I'm native Detroit. Born and raised. Born in Corner Garden. And raised in Southwest Detroit in Corner Garden. I went back and forth till I got 18, 19 years old.
Okay, and at 18, 19, before we get a little bit deeper into your story, give us a little background. What was Corner Garden like when you was growing up?
Well, you know, I was born, I left there when I was 3 years old, but I went back every summer. So what it was like for me to go from Southwest Detroit to go over to Corner Garden when I was a kid, Corner Garden was an area that I just love Corner Garden because it was energetic, man. You know, it was different. I mean, they had some guys in Corner Garden was a little bit hipper than the guys in Southwest Detroit.
Okay.
You know what I'm saying?
Okay.
Yeah, yeah. And it was the Far East Side. It was far from Black Bottom and stuff, but a lot of people who came to Corner Garden was from Black Bottom and so forth.
Because that was kind of a step up, right?
Yeah.
Things, right? And Corner Garden, more Black Bottom frame houses and things.
So that that's it.
That was a kind of moving on up, as we might say back then, right?
Yeah. As I understand, this would have been one of the first neighborhoods that they started, Black started buying houses.
Okay.
You know, buying houses. They was leasing houses before.
Down in Black Bottom.
Yes.
In the valley.
Mm-hmm.
So you grow up in Corner Gardens. At 19, you catch a bad break.
17.
17, you catch a bad break.
Yeah, I catch a case, yeah.
And you end up having to sit down for a hot second.
Yeah, 23 months.
So at this time, you ain't doing too much sophisticated. This was would it be fair to say this was a knucklehead case you caught?
I was a thug. You know, I was robbing. We were robbing white folks.
Okay.
You know what I mean? We would go in the white neighborhood and we would stick up bars when folks got paid.
Okay.
We stick up everybody in the bar. Yeah, I was just a kid, you know. I was 16 at
you
the time.
You were 16, right.
You know, I was 16 years old, yeah.
We're running with a bad crowd.
Yeah, yeah.
Or a good crowd, depending on how you look at it. What a bad, with a quarter mile. So you got to sit down at 17, you're 16, 17, you catch a case.
Right.
You have to sit down for how long?
23 months.
23 months. Yeah. Basically 2 years.
Basically almost 2 years. 30 months for being 2 years. I mean, 30 days for being 2 years.
For being 2 years. Okay, when you get out, you get introduced to the world of the confidence game.
When I get out, first I heard a lot about, I heard some things about the confidence game. And there was a gentleman that I had nuisance in Corner Garden that I had been hearing about, that you know, he was doing some clever things, you know what I mean? And I said, boy, I sure like to get with him. So,
because there's short cons,
yeah,
there's long cons,
right?
And most, is it fair to say that most people are more familiar with your short cons or your short confidence?
Yeah, yeah. But particularly at that time, most people, you know, they call them flat foot hustles, you know?
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then again, for the audience out there, if you guys it may be before some of your times, but anybody my age or older will remember Academy Award winning movie with Robert Redford and Paul Newman called The Sting.
Which
was maybe the seminum or most widely seen depiction of the confidence game.
I would say so. It's a con man's Godfather. Picture.
Just like the Godfather. For the gangster world.
Yeah, right.
That the Sting is the Godfather for the confidence game.
Yes, it is.
Yeah. Okay, so you get schooled. You hear about some clever things going on and some guys who can figure out a way to get some money.
Right.
Now, confidence game is, by definition, it's a matter of confidence. You have to instill trust and belief in the people, right?
Yes, right. And you first must have confidence in yourself.
I was
first.
So,
in order to have that confidence, somebody have to see confidence in you to believe the story. You know what I'm saying?
So it's just not something everybody can do.
Yeah. So it's confidence all the way around.
Right.
Yeah.
And they introduce you initially, before we get deeper into it, to what you and the federal government would end up falling out over, which was your pigeon drop situation. Was that the first angle of the confidence world you got exposed to, was this particular game known as the pigeon drop, or did you learn some other techniques first?
Well, no, I learned the pigeon drop, but I came up from scratch with it. Started with scratch. You know, you got a lower side of the pigeon drop, you got a middle side, and you got a higher side. I had no imagination that I would end up, you know, on the higher side like I did. Yeah.
Wow. Okay. So you get schooled and you work your way up from scratch.
Yes.
To the middle.
Right.
Then you guys take this pigeon drop game
to another level.
To another level.
Yeah, level that nobody had never heard of. You know, white people was playing the pigeon drop in the 30s and 20s. That was their game.
Okay.
But they were getting, you know, like if $2,000-$3,000 were taken back then in the 20s and 30s, that's a whole lot of money.
Well, that's like $100,000, $200,000.
Yeah, right, that's
money
a lot of money.
Yeah. So the white guys were doing it during the Depression, maybe even before the Depression.
Right, exactly. Before and after.
And now, of course, the thing with confidence is, we were saying, the white guy can do it because he's white and the mark is white.
Right. Mm-hmm. So, well, at that time, you know, during the 20s and 30s, one reason why blacks weren't in the confidence game, by and large, dealing with white folks, because what no white man going to trust no black man enough for the black man to con him.
Correct.
Yeah, he wasn't going to have a confidence, no faith in that. So you wasn't going to be able to con him.
So, and I say that because now we live in a world where there's plenty of black businessmen, plenty of black lawyers, we've had black presidents. The idea that in 1940, 1950, a white businessman being susceptible to a black guy coming to him with a scam or angle or a play or a deal might have been a stretch, right?
Yeah.
Because how was you even going to get to him?
You couldn't. Right. At that time.
So what made you guys kind of unique, you and your crew? You guys were some of the first guys from our community to bridge that gap.
Well, here's my experience with that.
Okay.
One day, a friend of mine out of Atlanta, Georgia, he's deceased now, so I'm going to mention his name, called Stale Bread. Stale Bread was, he's 7, 8 years older than I, but he was a hell of a confidence man, and he caught a white woman one time on a confidence game, and she had about $700,000-$800,000. At that time, we was getting like maybe a $20,000 stain, you know, on a regular basis, $10,000-$20,000 a week, you know, which was good money back in 1972.
You said $10,000-$15,000 a week.
Yes.
In 72.
Yes, sir.
That was a king's ransom.
Yeah.
Okay. So that's $40,000 a month. You do basic inflation, it's like $400,000 a month in today's world. It's a ton of money.
So that's the kind of money we were getting, you know, we riding around. So anyway, he called me to play the phone, you know, to help him, you know, in the confidence game he was playing. So I was the boss man. So he called me. I was the white Jew. You know, he called me. And when this lady had this $700,000+, at that time, I wasn't swift enough. I didn't have the education to know how to untangle that money, because she had it tangled up in stocks. And, you know, white folks, as you know, when they got money, they're not going to keep $700,000, millions of dollars in a bank account. Only a fool would do something like that. They have it invested.
Correct.
You know what I'm saying? So that when they put money in the stock market and so forth, the broker, he makes it where, you know, it's kind of a little difficult to get it out, because he wanted to stay there so he can keep making money.
Correct, correct.
You know, so he in the game too. He playing a confidence game, you know.
Right.
Yeah.
And he want to protect his angle from another confidence man, whether he's another stockbroker, another financial advisor.
Or
a flat-foot hustler. He don't particularly care. He need to keep his game going.
Yes, sir.
So he got to make it difficult for his people to get their money out of that.
Now you got it. Yeah. Now you got it. Nah, yeah.
So your man working you.
So
you playing the part. You the boss.
Right.
You the big Jew man.
So I couldn't pull it off. So we didn't do nothing with that mark. And so he told me. He said, "Ty, we gonna have to learn how to do this here, how to untangle that money, or else we ain't gonna really have no money one day." Because if we don't come to that level, we ain't gonna get no big money. So we went to work. We went to work at it to find out how to do that, you know.
And let me help the people here. So
okay,
basically you guys had to learn how people tie up their money, that they have stocks, what the procedure is to get your stocks into cash, because you need people to get to cash, basically.
I need the people to take their stocks and get cash, because it ain't
cash.
No good for me with the stocks. I need the cash.
You don't need stocks. You don't need bonds. You don't need precious metals, right?
Right.
You don't need coin collections. You need cash. But this is the work in the end. You need a...
I might take some coins.
You might take some coins. Okay, that's a real commodity.
Right. Yeah.
But so you had to learn how people with money handle their money.
That's true.
So this is not a hustle for a dim-witted person. You're obviously a very intelligent man.
Fairly.
Okay. Well, he's being modest. Now you had come up though to backtrack a minute. We were just saying a absolute legend in this town. You had some contact with people who know or don't know him by the street name Frank Nitti. People that know him as Frank Usher.
Frank was a friend of mine, man.
Okay.
Frank was a friend of mine, yeah.
Hell of a guy.
Yeah, Frank was a friend of mine, yeah.
And when you've been, because you've been on some other podcasts, Pimpin' Ken, 85 South and all.
Yeah, I've been on them.
And I don't know if those guys, Frank's name didn't come up. I don't even know if they're from, I know here in Detroit, everybody knows about them.
No, Frank's name didn't come up. No, it didn't come up, yeah.
So people in your world, even in the confidence game, because you mentioned one of Frank's businesses or business he was associated with, the Democratic Club.
Right.
But game, recognized game, people getting money, be around people getting money.
Right.
So you would be in those same circles with guys like him?
Yeah, you know, I'd be in the same circle with Frank Nitti and everybody else that was getting money and was coming through the Democrat Club at that time.
Okay.
Yeah.
And that was the place.
Oh, that was the place. Anybody couldn't get in there.
No.
You couldn't just get in the Democrat Club at that time in 69. You know, but I was running with some cats that were respected as young people. On the rise, you know, and older guys could tell us, oh, we let them youngsters in there. They all right. They going to be something one day, you know?
So, because I was going to say, you were kind of young to be in the Democratic Club then.
I was about 19 or 20,
And there was some serious guys.
But I was running with some cats.
There was some real serious guys in there.
I was running with some cats, man. You know, my man, Ronnie Richardson, you know what I'm saying? Yeah. Whiteside, you know.
Okay. So the guys you were running with had some real street, as they say
no
nowadays,
question about it.
Some street cred.
That's what I came from them guys with the game. You know what I mean? I came from them. They, you know, because like I said, I was just a thug. I came from them, you know. Yeah.
Okay. Now this pigeon drop thing that you took, we were saying this is something you had to travel. So you went to different cities with this situation.
Went all over the country. All over the country.
Mm-hmm. What would you say you guys' biggest mark ever was?
Let me see if I can say that.
You know what I'm saying? Okay, let me say. You guys will eventually catch a case. Let me. I'll help you out, right? Because we want to only deal with what's already been litigated.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Okay. Let's deal with that. Okay.
So,
let's deal with that.
Your case would be Jones versus the United States government.
Jones versus America. That's right.
Okay. It was a 35-count indictment.
35-count indictment.
You were telling us off camera you guys were hit with 35 counts.
About $3-4 million involved. It was taken.
$3-4 million.
Yeah.
And what year was this?
This was in 19. We got the caught the case in 1985.
Wow. $3-4 million in 1985 is the case you guys caught.
Yes.
You guys end up getting hit with 35 different counts.
Mm-hmm.
You guys had some good lawyers and some good legal minds yourself, because you say of those 35 counts, 15 of the counts end up getting overturned appeals.
We had 35 counts. We got found guilty on 16.
They ran them concurrently, obviously.
Obviously, right.
So for those of them, this concurrent means that you can get convicted on numerous counts. You can be doing time on 16 different cases all at the same time.
Right. Exactly.
So, thank God for you guys. The judge ran all your time concurrent.
Yeah. He could have run them consecutive if he wanted to, but he didn't.
He didn't hammer you.
Yeah. And so it took us 26 months later, the Court of Appeals reversed off them 15 counts that we found, 16 counts we were found guilty, they reversed 15. We beat 15 out of the 16. We got found guilty only on one account, and that was a conspiracy. And basically, the Court of Appeals said the only reason that the conspiracy wasn't dropped is because the conspiracy was never addressed properly by the attorneys. Because most people feel like, see, a lot of times you hear stories, oh, you can't beat the federal government, you can't beat a conspiracy and all that. You can't beat nothing if you don't try. You ain't got no confidence.
You sound like my deranged brother. I had to take that shot at you down in Florida. Eddie Jackson Jr., he's always a big proponent of going to trial and taking your shot.
Well, I'm not saying you should go.
You can't beat nothing in appeal if you don't fight.
Yeah.
That's what you're saying.
Certain times maybe you should go. You know, if they're not going to give you anything, you know what I mean?
Right.
You say, well, shit, you ain't going to give me no more than that. I'll get that if I get found guilty in a trial. So come on with it. Let's go.
But as you say, if he'd have ran them consecutive, boy, it'd have been a different situation.
Oh, man, it'd been crucial. It'd been crucial.
All right, so the case you guys catch in 85, mm-hmm. it's a $3-5 million case that the government say that you guys are involved in.
Right.
Needless to say, you had to be living a very comfortable lifestyle with that kind of money going through your hands.
We were, man. And at the level we were doing it, because most people that was in the confidence game was not living on that level, you know,
Did most people in our community think you guys were selling drugs to be living the lifestyle you were living, rather?
Yeah, most people think that. Now, let me make sure I understood the question. What did you say?
The people in our community, the people would see how you guys were living,
mm-hmm.
with the assumption be you guys were involved in the narcotics trade.
Oh, without a doubt.
For you guys to be handling, because
without a doubt.
At that point in 85, the numbers business has started to wane, but even so that the only people in our community that was handling that kind of money, because athletes and entertainers weren't making that kind of money back then.
That time, yes.
Were the people in the numbers, the policy business, or the narcotics trade. But you guys were not doing either.
No, we weren't.
But you were living the lifestyle that allowed you.
We were living the lifestyle. You know, we hung with those guys. We socialized with them, you know, and so forth.
Because you could keep up with them financially.
Well, we didn't necessarily have the top money that the top kingpins were having. But we could go everywhere they went.
There you go. Yeah.
I mean, to give you an example of what I'm saying, in 1973 or 74, I'm living in a building in Hackensack, New Jersey. Okay. And me and another woman and a guy is the only black in the building. Now, they're on the penthouse. I'm on about the 12th floor. They're on the penthouse. And this lady got big diamonds on everything, and you know, and I got my hat cocked to the side. She's looking at me, said, "This cold player here, I ain't even paying him no attention." You know, she looked at her. I said, "How you doing, baby?" She wouldn't even look my way, you know.
Uh-huh.
And so I see this guy since 74, this guy driving a Benz in the parking lot. Mercedes-Benz. At that time in 1974 in New York City, you can count the people on one hand that had a Mercedes-Benz.
For sure.
On 74.
That's a fact.
73 and 74. On one hand in New York City. Okay? So this guy had a Benz and had Pennsylvania license plates on it. And he dressed just like he looked like a businessman, looked like an attorney.
A banker or something.
Yeah, a banker or something. And I thought he was a square. I mean, he fooled me. I'm a confidence man. He fooled me. Yeah. And so he passed by. I said, "This guy's taking care of this girl." That's what I said. He's taking care of her. And one day I'm down in Harlem. Now,
I know who this is. We about to go, but go ahead, tell the public.
One side of the street.
I already connected the dots already. I know who it is, but go ahead.
One side of the street, they got a place they call the Gold Lounge. This was the big time drug boys. At yeah. Other side of the street, it's where a lot of players and hustlers hang out, called Shalimar.
Okay.
You know, we wouldn't get any kind of money that's necessarily big kingpins would get. Mm-hmm. They hung out over there at the Gold Lounge. So I come outside of the Shalimar, I'm in front of it, and people making a bunch of noise. And so I said, "What's going on, man?" They said, "Nicky Bonds is across the street."
I knew.
And I said, "Yeah." So I'm thinking I ain't never seen Nicky Bonds before. And then I look down the corner, and I see a car parked, double parked, a Mercedes-Benz. I said, "Wait a minute. I know that car." I said, "I wonder if that car got Pennsylvania license plates on it." So I stepped out in the street to look at the license plate. Sure enough, Pennsylvania license plate. I said, "I be goddamn, that's Nicky Bonds." I said, "That's Nicky Bonds. I've been passing every day and I didn't even know it."
Nicky says in one of his interviews, he's just talking shit and he's talking his game. He said, "Man, I was riding Mercedes-Benz when y'all didn't even know what they was."
He wasn't lying.
That's the truth.
I'm telling you what I seen. I ain't telling you what nobody I heard. I'm telling you what I'd seen.
He was driving Benzes in 73, 74.
That's right.
Wow. Yeah, so you've been around. So on that, in that same period, me and you were having another conversation about opportunities lost. You said in 1975 you had a female friend that suggested you go to China and look for some business opportunities.
Right. Man, listen.
75, this is. Somebody pulled your coat and said.
75. Nixon and Kissinger. Kissinger had just went over in China and okay, got everything worked out to open up the doors for American businessmen in China to do business.
Right.
And Kissinger had did that.
That's right.
Right. And she, I met her at a party.
You sent over on Pontchartrain?
I was over, it was on Pontchartrain Street, I think it's in,
Sherwood? Palmer Park.
Course, yeah. And we was over there. And she looked different from all the other women. She was conservative and she was sparkling, you know what I mean? Because she was drinking carrot juice back then and all that kind of stuff. And in 75, wasn't many people into health food and all that stuff, especially in the black community.
That's right.
In 75.
Right.
I had just got into it myself, right? Just got into it in 75. And so she was sitting there, she was glowing, and she was a few years older than me, man. And I went to talking with her. We must have romanced on the phone for 4 or 5 months before I even really got with her, you know. And when I got with her, she actually was a, she wanted to swindle institutions. She wanted to play the confidence games on institutions. I was used to playing it on individuals, you understand? But she said, if I could get this dude to understand what I'm saying,
we could get rich. Big money. She was talking about big money.
Yeah, you know? And she knew I had the heart to do it. Because a lot of guys, you know, a lot of blacks, when they get into, you know, be able to get a job and work in Wall Street and they the only black there, they scared to do anything. Mm-hmm. But she seen that, she said, this dude here, if I could get him, we could get rich. Because she knew all about the doors were opening up to do business in China and so forth. And she wanted to get me involved in it. Yeah.
So, needless to say, she was supporting you in the right direction.
Oh, no question about it. I just wasn't there at the time.
Now, you do tell me, though, that 20 years later, in 95, you were in Taiwan.
I went to Taiwan, correct.
And you went to Taiwan to put together a
gym shoe deal.
So you've been a forward-thinking man for a long time.
Yeah, you could say that.
So how did that all come about? What gets you, how do you in Taiwan trying to put together a gym shoe deal?
Well, when I got out of prison in 89, and I got off parole in 90, that's when I was over in Taiwan. Mm-hmm. When I got off parole, I thought about it. I said, you know, people in 90, wasn't many people who had a gym shoe deal at that time. But, you know, but I thought about it. I said, well, everybody wearing gym shoes and stuff like that. You know what I'm saying? It was a guy from here, I think in about 91, 92, guy from Detroit, young cat. He had some kind of gym shoe deal he was doing, but this was a couple of years later. But some kind of way I put it together, man, you know. So I said, well, let's go to, I was one of them kind of guys, if you say, well, hey, man, if we can go get some diamonds over in Africa, I said, well, how much it cost? well, if you got 15,000, we can get over and do it. I said, well, shit, I got that right here.
Look. I got that on my phone. Yeah, yeah.
Let's go, you know. Yeah. So I went to Africa then, and that same, about a year later, a year before that, I went to Africa for the first time, you know. I wanted to go to Africa. You know?
So you've been a world traveler. You've been to Asia, you've been to Taiwan.
I've been to Asia, Australia, you know, Bangkok, Thailand, you know, I've been in Thailand, and, you know.
And you're still traveling, so you're about to go to Brazil?
Yeah, I'm going to Brazil next month, God willing.
Speaking of being forward thinking, you see you cross-cast another guy, speaking of apparel and things, Dapper Dan.
Yeah, Dap is a friend of a friend of mine's, man. You know, and I know Dap too. Dap's a hell of a guy.
Yeah, it's amazing. He's another one that went from the outside To right square now, he is Mr. Inside.
That's right. That's right.
Which is, I think, a lesson our community can learn. That things we did in the past, they said, you on the outs, fast forward, now you're on the ends.
Yes.
Yeah. So before we wrap this up, though, I want to, we were joking off camera, not really joking, having a serious conversation. The skill sets that are needed to be a great salesman, like you are a natural born salesman. I was just checking if you'd like a family out there. If you look at the man's demeanor and just the posture, you feel confident handing him your money.
Right.
I had said I was sharing a quote I heard that if you take intellect with no opportunity leads to criminality.
Right.
You ever think that if you'd have come up in today's world with your natural charisma, yourself, your knowledge of self, what other opportunities you could have had?
Yeah, man, I had a many opportunities, man. You know, and didn't take full advantage of them. Some of it was based on a system, and most of it was based on me. I just didn't take the opportunity. But the difference between a good salesman, the question you're talking about, a good salesman,
right,
and a confidence man. I'm gonna tell you like my federal parole officer told me.
Okay.
When I got out of federal prison in 89, and I got transferred from Atlanta to Detroit, my federal parole officer, I'll never forget, Spanish guy, old Mexican, and he said, he's looking at my record, you know, he said, Mr. Stevens, obviously you're a pretty smart guy. He said, but I'm going to tell you something. They're going to be looking at you if you start go back to your old things, you know. And he said, but let me tell you the difference between a businessman and a crook. He said, a businessman will go so far to the gray area, then he's not going to go past that because he knows. He doesn't have any protection then, you know, if he goes past that. It protects him all the way in the gray area. He said, but now a crook, he has no regards for the law. He's going to go all the way. He don't care nothing about no gray area or nothing, you know. He said, but their ingenuity is the same, you know. Their inspiration and how they go about selling and all that, it's the same thing.
Same thing.
You know.
Because both... The reason why salesmen have always been, and to this day, it's the most lucrative profession to be in, is because salesmen calls for money transfers.
Right.
Transfers of wealth.
Yes.
Which requires confidence.
Right.
I've got to get party A willing to depart with their cash to give it to party B.
Right.
A salesman is the person that is that conduit or tunnel.
Yes.
But it can't happen unless the person has confidence.
That's right. That's right. And what I would say to the young people and people listening that interested in getting rich, get you something to sell.
Well, you know, the kids call what you guys were doing the confidence game. Now they call it finessing.
Yeah.
We live in a time where people attempt to finesse.
Yeah.
You know, it'd be the same game, different word.
Yeah, different
word. Con game, confidence game, even though con game is the abbreviation for confidence.
Yeah, right.
Which exactly. Maybe the audience isn't aware of that. When you hear about the con game, con is just the short for confidence.
Yeah, and it goes back to ancient Babylon. You know, the prostitution is the oldest game in the world.
Right.
That's number one. Prostitution.
Mm-hmm.
Number two is the confidence game.
It's
the
confidence game. That's it.
Yeah. That's the second oldest game in the world.
Because there was a smart guy in Babylon who saw a rich guy in Babylon, and he said, I bet I can talk to that guy and get him to give me his money.
That's right.
Because you know what? The fact that he's rich means he's got a little bit of greed in him. And greed always makes a man susceptible to be gotten.
That's true.
Because you were saying in your line of work, it's easier to get a rich man, obviously, to give you money than a poor man, right?
Right. I mean, I'd jump over a fence at a rich man. You know what I'm saying? Because that guy that ain't got no money, he's holding on so tight. You know what I'm saying? I mean, he don't want to hear no logic, you know, reasoning, no nothing. You know what I'm saying? Now, a rich man, you know, he feels, this guy here, he looks up to par. He got on nice shoes and nice socks. And, you know,
a rich man is used to taking calculated risk. Because, see, a rich man has lost money before.
Yeah.
Ain't nobody ever got rich who ain't already lost some money.
That's right.
So the rich man's view of money is different. Because he might even think you're running a scam. But if it's a 30% chance that you're telling the truth, he might be willing to risk it.
Yeah, he would go crazy if he didn't take that opportunity. And you got rich.
Yes. That's the way the wealthy think.
Yeah, that's true.
Because the wealthy buy penny stocks, do angel investing, invest in ideas. So that's what we were talking off camera. You know, they call it in the investment world of Silicon Valley an angel investor or a startup investor. That means I come to you, Mr. Stevens, I ain't got nothing but an idea and tell you I need some money. I ain't got no office. I ain't got no product. I got an idea. You should give me some money so I can put my idea in motion. And people do it.
Mm-hmm.
Now you talk about confidence. Venture capital. Yeah. I go to a rich man and say, man, I got an idea. I ain't got no money. I ain't got no product. But if I had some money, I could get the product made. And if I had some more money, I could promote. And you should give me some money.
Yeah.
And they write him a check based upon his words and his idea. It's not much difference now, is it?
No, not much at all.
And half the time, the money disappear.
Yeah.
So the rich man already know that's a chance I took.
As a matter of fact, it's the same thing. You know, one is just legal and one is illegal. But the same thing.
Same thing.
Same ingenuity. Same thing.
Same ability to pitch. Same what you thing. Were doing in white folks' terms or corporate terms, you're pitching.
Yeah.
I'm going to weave this story in such a fashion that this person will give me their money. That's the same thing they teach you in business school to try to. How to pitch. How to get somebody, based upon your conversation, to give you money.
That's right.
Except sometimes we do it as a confidence game, and when they do it, it's raising capital.
It's a gentleman.
Yeah, when you do it, it's a confidence game.
Yeah.
When they do it, I got to go raise some capital. You mean you about to go tell people with money to give you some money?
You smart dude, man.
Yeah.
I like this program here because you're a smart dude. You bring out, you know, the science of what, you know, I've been studying. I've been in confidence game over 40-something years, man. You know what I mean? And I know this game. I know this game. And what you're talking about on the business side, I very seldom come in contact with people like you to be able to get on a podcast like I am, and somebody bring the right questions out.
Well,
you know, ask me the right questions. You know what I'm saying?
That.
I mean, this is your first time. I don't say that, you know, to make you feel good. I say it because it's the truth. This is a top flight podcast you got here, man. This is top flight.
Appreciate
you know, in
that.
My opinion, you know.
Well, we believe that one of the advantages we got in this, and my audience already knows the world I come from, the whole world I come from.
Mm-hmm.
So I always thought it has allowed me to have some interesting perspectives.
Right.
To I understand, could imagine. And the last thing before we do, you know, you were saying you're a confidence man, but you're a man of integrity.
Yes, at the same time.
At the same time.
Yeah.
I may have been a criminal, my pops made a deal, but these are men whose words, who were, when they give you their word.
It's bond.
It's bond.
Yeah, it's bond. If I say I'm going to do something like me and you doing Like I know you, I play the confidence game when I go out with strangers. You know, yeah. I'm going in the Democrat Club and places around Detroit. I ain't got no pistol on me. Everybody in the joint got a pistol.
That's right.
You know what I'm saying? I ain't got none. You know, and ain't worried about nobody messing with me because I ain't doing nothing. You know, now I had some gangster training, but I ain't no gangster.
There you
know
go.
What I'm saying? You know, but
word,
I knew gangsters.
And you knew and you knew in that word, your word mean everything, really.
Hey, and I wasn't afraid to, like, some guys, man, I see other confidence men, when they knew I was friends with Frank, you know, they'd be scared to deal with Frank. But see, I'm not scared to deal with a man that deal with integrity because if you say, I'm scared to death of Frank to do something wrong to him.
Yeah.
You understand what I'm saying? Because
yeah.
I know what he'd do. Because if he do something wrong to me, I'm going to do the same thing.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? I'm saying? You know.
Yeah.
So we got along perfectly well.
Yeah.
You know. Me and Frank was friends till the day he died.
Man, yeah. I appreciate it. All right, any passing words? Well, before we go, you have a podcast of your own that obviously you are a wealth of knowledge. You've seen the world at levels and from angles that very few have. Obviously, the good Lord has been good to you. You look great.
Thank you.
Turning Point Podcast?
Turning Point Podcast. It's a podcast I'm just starting. I'm just kind of finding my way through here, but I plan on doing some great things with Turning Point Podcast. Tyrone Stevens. That's how you get it. Turning Point Podcast, Tyrone Stevens.
Turning Point Podcast, Tyrone Stevens. We'll make sure, Brother Lou, make sure we put that in the descriptions.
It's already there.
And you can do that. And also, you're going to be up on the other social media platforms, on Instagram, on YouTube, TikTok, and Facebook.
I'm on all four of them.
In fact, you were telling me you guys had a pretty popular video that already is up on TikTok, right?
Yeah, I got one up right now. A man had done 26 years in prison
because
he shot a police officer. He was a young kid at the time, 20 years old or something like that. Shot a police officer, and he got life in prison. Did 26 years and got out. After 26 years, he got out on some ingenuity of his own, and he got out, you know. And it's a very interesting story. And I'm interviewing this man, and his name is Mackie Allen, you know.
All right. Check that out, family. Again, doing what we do here at Motown Mafia Podcast, Big Boss Filmworks Production. Make sure you guys are hitting that like, share, and subscribe button. Make sure you guys check out Turning Point, Tyrone Stevens. Turning Point Podcast. Let's get it right now. Turning Point Podcast. Tyrone Stevens. Legend in the confidence game. Detroit legend, period.
From the makers of Motown Mafia, beyond the headlines, beyond the crime, beyond the glamours and gold, they don't run around the streets. They run the streets. Beyond Street Dreams. Coming soon.
What's the biggest, most successful conference movie ever made?
That would be House of Games.
Sting.
The Sting.
Ooh. House of Game was a good movie now.
Sting
wasn't best.
Sting wasn't
best to swept the Oscars.
Yes.
Yeah. That won everything.
Paul Newman won best supporting, best actor. Robert Redford won best supporting actor. And Sting won best movie of the year.
The Sting movie, like the Godfather movie is to a gangster.
That is a
The movie. Sting, that's the movie for a con man.
For the confidence game, exactly.
Yeah.
That is the Godfather of the confidence.
That's the game. Because that's where you see real good. I must have seen the movie 200 times.
And as a child, I saw this.
And every time I see it, I see something different.
Yeah, no, it's a great movie. No, they did it. They showed what the Long Con.
Now they really had a black dude
really
that was
like.
In the Robert Earl Jones' brother that was in the movie. From remember the old black man who they killed.
Mm-hmm.
Was name in the movie? His name was Luther Coleman. They killed him. He had turned Robert Redford out. Robert Redford was just a poor white boy. He was poor trash in the movie.
Yeah.
And this black man hit him, but black man, Paul Newman was the big time con man.
Yeah, yeah.
He knew Luther.
Yes.
He knew Luther was the best street worker he had ever seen. But Luther knew he couldn't play no big con, because at that time in the 30s, wouldn't a white man trust a nigga enough to con him?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Exactly.
That's how they had the movie.
Yeah, yeah.
I knew
that. That was accurate.
Yeah, yeah.
Paul Newman knew Luther was a bad man.
Yeah. But they went to real con men to get the information to really make this movie. So
they because it was too authentic.
Oh, no way! It's no way nobody who didn't know it could have knew all that unless he talked to somebody. Because those are tricks and trades, you know what I'm saying? That you just don't know. You know what I'm saying? And Ken knew a guy. Pimpin' Ken knew a guy. He's from Milwaukee. He knew a guy that I knew in the joint that was an older guy that was friends of his. And when he found out I knew this guy, he was. Oh man, you know Sam? Me and Sam, you know, we talk all the time, you know. Because Sam was a short, he was a flat foot, which is a short confidence player. He's a flat foot genius. You know what I mean? But when he comes upstairs, he could never keep him not being high. You know? See, I've never been high playing the confidence game. I get high afterwards.
Yeah, trust me.
I'm celebrating.
Trust me, I get it. Trust me, I get it.
Yeah.
Exactly. No, I need to be on my game to get my game right so I can go celebrate.
Yeah, you know, then I'm going to celebrate now. No question about that.
Yeah,
now.
Yeah, yeah.
Some champagne, some cold games, some freaks, and everything.
That's right. Oh, yeah, we're going to have ourselves a good. We're going to have ourselves a Roman holiday once the job done. Yeah, once the job done, we're going to have a Roman holiday.
But anyway, let's move on. What's your opinion at this point? Because you got to general idea of what for me to ask you this question. I wasn't comfortable at that time, and Ken told me something. He said, man, you statute of limitation up on you, which it is. You know what I'm saying? I'm not worried about that, but it's just the fact that for me to get on Channel 9 and tell the whole world, you know, white folks say, nigga, now we let you out of the penitentiary. You know, you didn't get too bad. You only got 3 years. We tried to give you 10, but you won some cases in the Court of Appeals. You got out, you know, they cut it down from 7 to 3. I did 28 months and got out of Milan.
He was very familiar with Milan.
Yeah. So I got out of there. And, so, but me saying this here, and see, because if youngsters would look and just see, read, if they read, but see, white folks know niggas ain't gonna read. Majority. Because what he put with the judge's opinion is enough for niggas to start playing white folks and get rich.
Well, white folks play white folks every day and get rich.
Yeah.
I mean, We buy insurance. We do all kind of shit with on promises that one day the people gonna do and say what they gonna do. We pay for funerals and burials years in advance. We give the insurance company our money, then we make a claim, then the insurance company try to deny the claim, and we still play this game. We believe that Progressive gonna do what they say.
So what do you think? You think I could say this?
I think I get it 100%. Let me tell you what I tell when me and my friends and guys, my dad.
You don't understand my question?
I do. And this is using my response. Let's be clear, fellas, we all breaking the rules. Because we all come up in a world and was raised that our thing was our thing and we didn't talk about our thing with squares. We didn't make the world change. We didn't know one day it was going to be some shit called the internet. And we didn't know that one day all these squares was going to be fascinated by this gangster lifestyle. So let's be clear that we all breaking the rules. The Italians breaking the rules, the Irish breaking the rules, the Chinese niggas. Now we last as always to figure out the world change. We gonna give them, my spin is always, some of the shit we done did gonna go to the grave with all of us.
See, we so can what, get, some
things gonna still go to the grave.
Yeah, okay.
Everything ain't to be spoke about.
All right.
But we can give the square world want a peek into our world.
Yeah.
Let's give them a peek into our world. Because the difference between a good salesman and a good confidence man, boy, that's a hairline. That's a hairline.
Man,
you talk about some thin difference, boy.
Man, listen, you funny dude, man. You really the funny, smart cat. Really, to be honest with you. Yeah. I like talking with you from the very start, from the time we talked. I like talking with you. Now, we talked one time before, other than, I don't know if you remember or not. It was during the time when they had was that the Super Bowl somewhere, and I think you were going to a, you had some people, and we talked for a second. Tatum was on the strand, and we talked for a split second, but you were busy with some people, and you made a statement, and you said something about, I said something, and you said, well, man, you said something. And I said to myself, I said, this dude pretty smart, you know. But what I mean by it, I like the way the analogies that you use. I like that. I mean, you damn near, if I was sitting there talking with you, you damn near sound like a confidence man yourself. I mean, you're sitting there talking. That's why you say it's a thin line between the cell.
Yeah.
Well, let me tell you what my fellow pro officer told me. He said this in another way. When I got out of Maryland, I had 6 months parole. That's all I had left. And he said, look, I got transferred from Atlanta to Detroit. And he said, well, he was a Mexican dude. He said, Mr. Stevens, let me tell you something. I'm looking at your file. Obviously, you're pretty smart. He said, but they're going to be watching you. He said, well, let me tell you the difference between a businessman and a crook. That's what the pro officer said. He said, now, a businessman will go all the way to the gray area, and he will stop. He said, a crook have no regards for the gray area. He going all the motherfucking way. He said, but
that's a great analogy.
He said, their ingenuity are the same.
Yes. Yes. Because I'm a good businessman, a good salesman for, if I'm selling expensive things, it's based in the end, it's on confidence. You don't know about this jewelry. I know. I got to instill enough confidence in you, into me, that you would give me $100,000, $200,000 for some jewelry or some gold or whatever based upon the faith you have in me, because you don't know. You don't know about diamonds. You don't know about jewelry. I'm at selling suits at Neiman Marcus. I'm trying to sell you a $10,000 suit. You don't know nothing about this. I got to explain it all to you. So you got to understand that this was made in a small village in Italy, and it was hand sewn, you understand? And these buttons is ivory and other. And after I get done, I have instilled enough confidence in you to have confidence in me that this suit, that don't look that much different than the $400 suit, is worth $10,000. And I got to make you feel good about that decision. I got to make you feel so good about it, you'll go defend, you'll repeat what I said to somebody else when they question your judgment about the confidence you had in me. Thing is, what the parole officer, only thing I'd have said to your parole officer is, now the difference between the businessman and the con man is, the businessman has identified the cons he can do under the law. He's just a little bit clever. I don't even know if it's a distinction between gray area, right? Because the Ponzi scheme is fine until I run out of new people. In fact, it doesn't become a Ponzi scheme until I run out of new people to keep the Ponzi scheme going.
Yeah, to pay it off, yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
And you don't know how many businesses are really Ponzi scheme, or the Ponzi scheme bought them enough time to hit a lick to clear up everybody. And sometime when I don't hit a lick to clean up the Ponzi scheme, the businessman calls it bankruptcy. I've taken all these people's money, told them that we were investing in an oil well in Texas. These motherfuckers live in New York, Connecticut, Atlanta. They don't know what the fuck I'm talking about. It's an oil well in Texas. You should give me some money, because we're going to drill for oil. And they gave me all this money, but I've incorporated. I got LLCs, I've got accounts, I've paid tax returns and all of the above. Don't nobody ever seen no. Ain't no one seen no oil. In fact, I'm telling you, we're drilling for oil. I'm getting your money based upon not even oil that we found. I'm getting your money on the belief that I'm telling you, experts say is oil in the ground over there in Fort Worth, and we gonna drill. We need money for equipment, and we gonna all hit this lick when we strike oil, and we gonna split up the money. And then after 5 years, I done collected $25 million. We still ain't struck oil. guess my geologist was wrong. Because now it's time to file bankruptcy. Now, in the meantime, over the last 5 years, I've paid myself a $3 million a year salary. Somebody, I'm the president of the company. I deserve a salary, right? So I raised $25 million in investments. I decided to pay myself $3 million a year, and you was my man, and you my vice president. So we took $15 million in salaries. The other 12, we honestly did. Fuck around. Long time. We bought equipment. We hired a geologist from the University of Texas. And we did right with half the money to cover myself. And then, when it's all said and done, we got to file bankruptcy. We ain't got no more money. We can't get no more investors. Investors write the shit off on their taxes. I file bankruptcy, sell whatever equipment we got in liquidation. And everybody walk away. The white man do that long con every day, all over the planet. And hides behind bankruptcy laws to say all the people that I ain't got to pay. And I didn't coerce them or trick them into giving me my money. Just told them I was trying to do something.
Excellent analogy, man.
Oh, yeah.
Excellent analogy you just made. And like I said, when Trump was in office, I said to myself, they talking about Trump. I should write a book about the pigeon droppers in the White House. Because he was playing the pigeon drop from the White House. You understand what I'm saying? You know, he was playing with all the all the insurance companies, all the, you know, who want to change their rules and the benefit of them. You understand what I'm saying? And he'll get Congress, you understand what I'm saying? Call a couple of buddies, oh, pass that fucking law, you know. You understand what I'm saying?
But he's the first honest crook to tell the people, no, I don't pay no taxes. And why the fuck you pay any taxes? Because you ain't took the time to learn how not to pay them. I ain't did shit wrong. The law say if I structure my shit this, that, and the way, I can make all kind of money, lose money, borrow more money, and don't pay nobody back, and I do that. Because that's the law. I've done nothing wrong. Y'all the only ones. And I tell black people all the time, why are you mad at that man for not paying taxes? Because I know I pay my accountant a lot of money to try to figure out every way in the world for me not to get a government my money. Seems he's got better accountants than I do. Seems like the more you make in America, the easier it is to keep it all. Hmm. And the less you make, the more they take from you. So with all that said, I think, yeah, we don't have to go in the, because, A.
I like the fact that, well, you said it. We give a peek into it.
We give a peek into it.
Yeah, I mean, I understand it all the way.
And true enough, like all good criminals or good businessmen, and they tend to be the same personality types. Right? You find me a good con man, I'll show you a good salesman. You show me a good salesman, I'll show you a good con man. Mm-hmm.
Excellent way.
right? It's a way, because there's some things about understanding human nature. Things that, I'll describe the things that make a good salesperson. Instinctively being able to read people, understanding human nature, understanding appearances and look. Understanding if I look like money, I'm already halfway home with the person mentally, and they don't even know it. You look like you dress like I'm supposed to give you money. You look like somebody I should give my money to. You carry yourself. You're sitting like a man who's comfortable with money and authority, and so therefore, body posture, all these little things that are subtle but so important. You can tell a motherfucker who ain't used to never having nothing. You can. Hey, how he talk, how he look, how he, not just how, you can, I could put you in some sweatpants and gym shoes and a hoodie, but if you sitting like you sitting, I see through what you wearing. Your posture gonna tell me more than your apparel. All these little things that a good salesperson or a good con man. Good con man, before you can be dressed like a bum and I'll talk to you 5 minutes and be like, nah, nigga, you got money. I don't care what that hoopty you pulled up in or whatever you wear. I done listened to you and I done seen, because you can't change your body.
Yeah, you can't hide that.
You can't hide that.
No, you can't hide that. You understand? That's some funny shit you just said. Like, it's more difficult to play the confidence game on somebody that has short money than somebody that have a whole heap of money.
Yeah.
Somebody with a whole heap of money is easier to play them, because first of all, they don't think you would ever come with that street game. You would never come to them with that. Because they don't hear that every day. Because the street player, he's not going to go where that guy is going to be at. First of all.
You can't even get in my company to con me, nigga. You can't even get in my company. Right, you can't even get in my orbit to run your game on me.
That's right.
The fact that you in my orbit mean I almost trust you now, because you know you clever for you even to be in my company. Possibly get me.
And the federal judge also said, Jive Rascal, he also said this. He said, although this statue here is a white collar crime statute, I see these guys no more than common criminals.
Yeah, judge got to tell you that.
He's saying, I don't see these niggas no more than with some niggas. You understand what I'm saying? Although they're charged with some white collar crime. You understand? Which we went back later on and beat all that. But it took 20-something months to do it. And in the meantime, I'm in the joint. You know? We wound up beating all the cases but the conspiracy. And could have beat that. The Court of Appeals said, well, the lawyers never addressed it properly. Because they could keep saying, well, you can't beat a conspiracy. You can't. The Court of Appeals said, if it had been addressed, it's all bullshit, so we would have thrown the conspiracy out. But you never properly addressed it. So we give them the conspiracy. Out of 15 counts, we beat 14. In the Court of Appeals, everyone but one, the conspiracy.
You beat 15 out of the 16 counts. The original indictment was a 16-count indictment.
No, the original one was 35, but we got found guilty on 16.
You guys got 15 of them dismissed or overturned.
In the Court of Appeals.
Overturned in the Court of Appeals.
Now, Charleston White, check this out. This is maybe something you play around your head, you pretty smart dude. You might do something with this. Charleston White talks about, he have a lot of respect for Weasel, and he got a lot of respect for, he said it was once upon a time when blacks were thinking about doing crime, they'll go throw a rock over in the white neighborhood and break a white woman and run back over on the black side. You know, pass out the money, everybody is cool. Hey, here, get you something, Gordon. Yeah. You understand what I'm saying?
Yeah.
But now, niggas are scared. They in their own neighborhood, robbing and shit one another because they're scared to go to the white man over on his side because he didn't put the fear of God in them. Huh?
So true.
I spoke about this here, man, in Jackson Prison to Frank Nitti, God bless a dead friend of mine.
Okay, I had dinner with Frank maybe 90 days before he transitioned. When you said Conant Garden and when you said the Democratic Club, that was the first thing I was like, well, then you got to know you got to know Frank.
I mean, Usher, I was like I helped him get out of the penitentiary because I gave him some money when I got out. I got out and got straight. You understand what I'm saying?
Yeah. Him and Daddy was friends.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I had dinner with Frank. 90 days before it passed.
But let me make the point. What was we talking about?
White black folks now got the fear of God instilled in them about going. Unlike Charles was saying, black folks used to throw a rock at the white folks, go back.
Yeah, Charles and White share
the benefit with the black.
Charles and White, he talks about what happened to that man, you know, and he talks about the confidence. He mentions something about the confidence game. If you go back and watch him, but he talks about it from a smaller scale than what I'm talking about.
Oh no, you guys too.
But he still talks about it.
Yeah.
Because he knew it's a whole lot of dudes over there in Fort Worth and Texas. They, you know, they play a game.
I assume this was a game you guys took on the road.
Oh, this is a road game.
I mean,
you know, and so most of the guys that very few guys out of Detroit played this here. Most guys from the South.
Really?
Really. Now, the guys, the crew I come out of Detroit was known, it's known cross country. The crew I come out of from Detroit, it's like, these niggas is big. They thought we was just jiving about confidence. We actually were selling dope because we had too much money.
The people can't imagine Yeah. I just been around. I said a pigeon drop I'm new to, but I know some people that run some long, they ran some long cons and got some real money. That you would think only when they come up with that kind of money that quick, he got to be selling dope. Ain't no other way. Ain't no other lick.
Impossible.
Ain't no other lick that can be hit like that, but with a bag.
You got the point.
And then when you tell him, nah, man, the man handed it to me.
He went east and you went west.
What you mean he handed it? And then don't tell him this part. And when it went down, won the gun in the room.
Yeah.
It's beyond yeah but that's a good question. What happened to that? What happened to we do these things in other people's community but we won't do it in our own community?
Well it's the fear of God.
Yes,
the fear of God, what they put in. See, like in this town in 65, before 65, before the dope came real, it was dope, but everybody didn't know.
No,
it was dope.
It was a secret society.
Yeah, yeah, very much a secret society. You know what I mean? So, and people who were robbing, they went out in white folks' area and robbed a loan officer, A&P, you know, they didn't, so Judge Gillis and them in Detroit, they say, well, we give these niggas 30 to 40 for robbery, 50 to 60, you know. Because I come along in 66, I was robbing. I got waiver from juvenile to adult court, you know, at 16 and 65, you know. And they started giving niggas 25 to 30, Judge Gillis and Geraldine Ford.
Oh, Judge, hanging judge.
Yeah, you know what I'm saying? They started giving niggas big time. So now,
Ford, haven't you?
Who was that now?
Judge Geraldine Ford.
I have heard of Geraldine.
Yeah. Geraldine, give a nigga, tell a nigga go count how many cars drive by, and that's how many years you got.
So look here, I got 2.5 to 15. I'm in the joint in 66, and they went to come in there with 30 to 40 and 50 to 60. I said, Lord have mercy. I got to find something else to do. Because I can't get back out and do that. That's too much time.
Yeah, that's too much time.
2.5 years, that was enough for me.
Yeah.
So, but the point I'm making, so when I get out, in November 19th, 1967, I walk into Southwest Detroit, down at River Rouge East Coast in Southwest Detroit. I walk up to the pool room on Visigon Road, and I go in the pool room, and niggas is whispering to niggas. And they handing something. I can't see what they handing. And I'm shooting pool. Niggas say, hey, Ty, you home, man? And the nigga called me back in the back. He said, hey, Ty, come here. He took a capsule of heroin, penny cap. He said, hold your hand out like that. I'll help my hand out like that. He put some white powder. He said, now sniff that like that. And I turned and gave him my back. And dumped it. I act like I sniffed it, but I didn't. I said, thanks, man. And I went back to shooting pool. I was shaking. I said, oh, Lord, that's what they doing. Because I couldn't figure out what the hell they was whispering and passing shit. But that's the first time that I seen hand-to-hand combat. It was when I left in January of 66 and 65, you didn't see that. When I come back in 67, some niggas that couldn't be I had to be on their porch when the street lights was on before they come on, and they would get money, had the head there, and they was passing shit. What the fuck is going on? You know what I'm saying? But I had a brother die when I was in there of overdose of dope, I was telling you earlier. So that shot me away from using heroin until they tricked me, like with the coke, you know. But
well, that's what I was saying. Well, I mean, I knew I came down. I seen and know you do heroin, you're gonna be a junkie. So you ain't never have to worry about me trying it. The heroin was to be sold to people who, for whatever reason, feel to want to self-medicate themselves on that. But don't you be no fool and use that shit.
Man.
But, yeah, cocaine was at the time a different, it was a different.
So back to the story. Yeah. Now, when I get out, so they, 67, come, everybody got the drugs, so they got dope houses now. Mm-hmm. You understand? In the community, they got dope houses. So niggas said, because of Geraldine Ford and all them, niggas say, well, we don't have to go rob white folks no more in this 40 years. We'll go rob the nigga selling dope, and he can't tell the police. Because he's doing wrong. Now, all the dissension came amongst everybody in the neighborhood. This, now, this in 67 I'm talking about. After the riot, when the riot come in June, July of 67, the U.S. government in Detroit just drops drugs via through the mafia in the city of Detroit, goddamn it, like, just like that. Mm-hmm. You understand what I'm saying? Now, you know, the rest of it is history.
We have captured all this, didn't we? Audio?
We got it. From the point that we have the recording.
All right, so that's good for Spotify.
They're good. Yeah.
But let's get you ready to get on camera?
Yeah,
I know. You need to be in that chair. You don't need to be on the stool. So let's get. Yeah, you're looking that chair.
Okay.
Bring that chair
over. Yeah.
What do I get over here?
Yeah, I'm gonna put you in front of the lights.
Do you, can I get one of those cups?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
What's your last name, Mr. Tyrone?
Stevens. Stevens.
O-Y-B King.
With a PH.
Ah. Somewhere down the line.
And I damn near feel like a, to be honest with you, I damn near feel like 100 pounds have been lifted off of me because I ain't had nobody to talk with you to understand.
Can I get this chair for you?
Yeah.
You understand what I'm saying?
Uh-huh.
I mean, if I talk to go talk with a hustler that do that, he can't understand why I'm finna get on TV. Niggas, you crazy?
Well, you gotta understand this thing we've been doing last year. These kind of guys, getting these kind of guys in front of cameras, was not an easy thing. But then I hit him with this. We can't change the past, one. Two, it's history. One day, these people gonna tell all our stories with or without our permission. Don't we at least owe it to our community and to our families to let the story at least be one real version from us?
I feel the same way, man.
Because it's the truth.
Because one day they're gonna be talking about the Compton game.
Oh, it's dropping everything. Compton's game is all coming. Mm-hmm. Wait a minute. People just, because we don't look in windows. Jesse James and the younger brothers is folklore. There was bank robbers, John Dillinger and Pretty Boy Floyd, Ma Barker, and all of them who was robbing banks. Now they became heroes. Al Capone and Lucky Luciano and the Purple Gang. Now this is a part of American history. Finally, they come with the policy game, a little bit Hollywood talk, a little bit in the Cotton Club and hoodlums about the policy kings. And I got some friends that we want to maybe do a little bit deeper dive because we don't believe, we ain't really went into the numbers business and how it affected the black community. And if Number Man was the bank of the black community, long before it was black banks.
And now the Arabs is banking the numbers.
And now the Arab is taking the billions that used to circulate among us. Talk about throw the rock. And the same thing you're talking about, Charleston White talking about. And every day they collect all this money in our community and then take it back to their community. And we ain't got enough sense, so true, to see nothing. The Number Man used to collect the money in our community and then reinvest and spread the money back around. our community.
Right.
So it really was truly just, he was just the gasoline and the organizer of the money. Because the community gave him the money.
If it don't be for him, we wouldn't be in Harlem nowhere.
We wouldn't be nowhere. It's only the truth. Without him, it wouldn't have happened.
See,
it wouldn't be Deeks Funeral Home. Wouldn't have been no Stinson. Wouldn't have been no Swanson.
But when
wouldn't
one
have been
guy,
no McPhail. The Pi Funeral Home people, they live down the street from us.
I just come out of the Pi Funeral Home yesterday.
The Pi, you know this big number of people. They grew up, they live down the street from us in Southfield. The Parham family. Most of all the blacks who could get out the South, the number of people, those people who else could get out there with them white folks. The Pi family.
Wingate.
Mick Wingate. Come on, man. Ain't nobody in this town. Square as you can be. The biggest square in this town got a Wingate story.
We got that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Because that's how much impact old man Wingate had, Bigfoot had on this town. Because who else you going to get some money from?
Listen. Joanne's out there in Vegas. I wanted to do a story. I'm doing a bit in Colorado, but I'm outside doing a bit with an ankle brace. I'm going to write a story about Wingate. So I have Black Patty. I just love it.
You just love Patty?
She was at my man's thing.
I should have known. Yeah, obviously I know Patty well.
But let me give I'm moving so fast. I'm ready with you, man, because we can talk this shit all night long. You know what I'm saying? Hey, but check this out.
Players, no players.
Yeah. Check this out, man. If I say this shit that we've been talking about by myself, it's questionable to a motherfucker whether or not that happened. But if two people say and go to talk about the same thing, then that is all together different.
Well, you get the full credibility of every gangster in the city on this platform. They know we don't have no flip-flops or half people on our platform. You get on this platform. You the real deal if you get on this platform. We don't have, as my dad used to say, we don't have flip-flops on this.
Listen, state. I've been. Man, they used to come down, goddamn, with sacks of money, goddamn, to the Democrat Club,
yes,
to gamble.
Yeah.
With sacks of money.
Sacks of money. Literally, sacks of money.
I'm telling you what I know. I'm 19, 20 years old. I'm right there. 69. They wide open then.
Wide open.
Wow. That's the
wide open.
I ain't asking, was they open? I'm telling you.
No. We don't have pretend people on our platform. They know you on this platform. You've been certified. You've been certified and qualified. Yeah.
But I'm just saying, two people talking about it.
I know even.
It makes it.
We do it. I go through it. I can tell stories I've told a thousand times.
I got you.
Yeah. When I bring in the other people who lived it and did it with me, it brings a whole nother element to it. Your case, again, just to get started, it was Jones versus the USA. United States government versus Jones. That was the case?
Huh? Jones versus America.
Versus the United States government.
Yeah, it's a true story. Yeah.
Well, it's going to be about 20, 25 minutes, so we won't overtax you. Because we got a lot of good audio already.
Would it be all right if after that I can get a link and put it on my?
Oh, definitely.
Okay.
Definitely. Yeah. Okay. We do content share. We're the real thing. We always share content with our talent and vice versa. When other people interview me, because we learned you got to always set up. It's a big moral out there. We need to put it up on many platforms. It's possible. But I love it. This is an angle, and we've never had anybody from the confidence world speak. I'm very aware of it.
And I'm from Detroit.
And you're from Detroit.
Born and raised.
But you got schooled through this pigeon drop game.
After I come out of prison for robbery, and I'm 19, I got schooled when I'm 19 years old from a guy that I've been knowing since I was 6 or 7.
But this guy schooled you here or down south?
Here.
Here.
I got here. But I got tightened up from a lot of people. I learned from a lot of people, and a lot of them happened to be from the south.
South.
But the first one was from him, and he got tightened from somebody from the south. South.
They was a little more clever.
Yeah, I mean, you know, they had to play games and, you know, stay alive you with know, the white man.
I don't know if you ever heard this. Intellect minus opportunity equals criminality. You can't not give a smart man opportunity, because if you don't give him opportunity, his intellect's going to demand him to do something, which then leads to criminality. Because you can't expect a smart man to... Smart man ain't going to stay poor. And if you don't give him a legitimate path to use that intellect, oh, don't worry about it.
He'll figure it out.
Don't worry about it. Don't worry about it. Yeah, don't worry about it. You ain't got to worry too much.
This is what's happening right now.
We'll figure this out. Yeah, we'll figure this out.
I had the boy up in New York, Dapper Dan.
Wow, we was just
friend of mine. Friend of mine, Dapper Dan, right? Matter of fact,
you
know they called me yesterday because they had somebody. I had to see if somebody want to get, they looking for somebody from Brazil for an apartment up there in Harlem. And they knew my friend had a woman own a brownstone up there she was renting out. And I know Dap. Dap told me, I seen Dap come down in Atlanta, told me, he said, man, white folks, he told some people when I come in, he said, now you see the picture, you remember the picture of the Sting? And two young dudes, they said, yes. That's him.
Yeah.
Now.
Yeah.
But I hadn't been comfortable with that for the simple reason when I was coming up and, you know, in my height, in my prime, if they knew you was a confidence man, they thought everything you said was a lie. I only told lies when I'm trying to get money.
When you work, but I come from that world.
You know what I'm saying? Other than that, I got integrity. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
Yeah.
That's a job. I tell lies.
Listen,
part of my-
how can me and Frank be friends? I mean, Frank would come to me for mental stimulation. Man, what you think about? He don't come to fuck with me because I'm tough or nothing like that. He don't need to fuck with no nigga. He's tough enough.
He don't have tough niggas. He needs some smart niggas to talk to.
You know what I'm saying?
He needs some smart niggas to talk to. Yeah, I get it. Yeah, he don't need to go to no killer.
No,
just some insight.
Just like they told him in The Godfather. He said, I don't need gangsters. I need some more lawyers.
That's what he tells his nephew. That's right. We got enough of that.
Yeah.
It's just for popping them dope. We don't need your help selling dope. He told me go out to New York and learn how them white folks do what they do. We got that. We got a whole family and network to sell dope. We don't need your help with that. What we need help is figuring out how these white folks is moving this money and they running this business thing.
Yeah. Depp said, man, white folks love criminals, man.
They the best.
When he told his story, they loved that.
Let me tell you something. I got more pushback. Only people, and I've said it all, only people who I get that black folks, y'all destroyed the community, you drug dealers, shit, be from us. My white friends, when I came out with that book, they went to talk about, you know, my daddy was an accountant for the Purple Gang. Oh, my granddaddy, we ran all the speakeasies down in Wyandotte. We was... Uncle and them, grandpa and them was bringing the booze across the... because they know. You got to do in America is a common story among every ethnic group. The ethnic group was on the outs. They had to do what they had to do to get to
get in. You get them a piece of
the pie. The Polish know it. The Italians know it. The Irish know it. Lord know the Jew most sympathetic. Because he didn't have to do it. He didn't, bro. Ain't no bigger gangster that people don't truth be told. The Jew the one taught the Italian how to be a gangster. Yeah. The Jew taught the Italian how to be a gangster.
Yeah.
Yeah. If the truth be told, the Jew taught the Italian how to really be a gangster.
That's right.
Then he taught the Italian after we get the money being a gangster, that's how you clean up the money. And he understood two generations from now, they ain't gonna even remember where the money came from. They don't care where the money came from. You know as I do, don't nobody care where you get the money from. In America, we care about whether you got money or don't. America just judge you and treat you on how you, either you got money and I treat you nice, and there's nice things we can do, or you ain't got no money and I treat you bad and it ain't nothing we can do. Because I really don't care how you got it. Because if you knew how I got mine, the Whitey Low, if you knew what I did to get mine, it'd make you blush. You pimp out 50 broads. I pimp out countries. Right, I pimp out entire cultures and countries. And you niggas think you done did something slick because you got 20 broads working. And I got 2 million broads working for me.
Every day.
Every night. Day.
They don't ever sleep.
Don't ever sleep. You know, let's talk about criminals. All right. You about ready?
Okay. Yes, sir.
All right, let's get to talk.
From the makers of Motown Mafia, beyond the headlines, beyond the crime, beyond the glamours and gold, they don't run around the streets. They run the streets. Beyond Street Dreams. Coming soon.